Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Mac Attack Show. This is your host, J Mac, and I'm delighted and excited that you're here with us on today. It's been a minute, but I'm glad you're here with us on the Mac Attack Show. And I'm doubly excited today as we have our guest, my friend and my brother, the great man of Harrisburg. Listen, you are not in Harrisburg or Central Pennsylvania, if you're not truly from this area, you're not truly connected if you don't know this man. So give it up for Carl Singleton. Yeah. Carl, how's it going, my brother?
I'm well. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you, man. Thank you, man.
We've been doing and engaged in since your feet touched the ground here in the capital city, Harrisburg. So I appreciate you, brother.
No, man. I often wish I could do more. But you have been a blessing to me and just the city. And so I could say that over and over again, but somebody may be wondering, well, what is it that he does that's so special? So could you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and why you do what you do?
So for me, the thing is not the title, right?
And, mm-hmm.
Not to be disrespectful to various titles that I've had, from educator to senior advisor to, you know, equity and compliance officer and other, you know, professional titles in between. The greatest title I think I have honed in on servant leader, and that embeds advocacy. And unapologetically, Black man from the public housing, you know, single parents, you know, two unwed parents. I always tell people, you know, I was raising my mom and dad since they were 16. That's the running joke, you know, they mm-hmm. have seen, but I was always surrounded by love and expectation, love and high expectation. Even though we have a lot with regard to material things, that you could sense the expectation of you to be successful and you to do well and for you to be, you know, in touch with your moral compass and to do unto others as you have others doing to you. That was, even without the words, it was something that was innately felt, you know, by me and my sister growing up, no matter what environment we were in. So what do? I try to make sure that I'm the leader, the advocate, and that individual at the table that I wish was there when I was growing up in this community that didn't have courageous leaders to make an impact for the masses, as opposed to just taking for the chosen few. When I was growing up here, there were a lot of faces that looked like ours, that we believed in, that quite frankly capitulated and took for self, as opposed to doing what was in the best interest of the masses. And I promised myself that if God ever put me in a position, as my mom would always tell me, I would get in that position and I should empower the position and not be empowered by the position. And that starts with understanding that you have servant leadership, you know, at the core of everything you do. So that moral compass is far from perfect, trust me. But in terms of, you know, doing what's right as opposed to what's convenient, that's always been, you know, that perspective that I've taken on. And I've been quite frankly, sometimes it's cost me relationships, friendships, invites, etc. I became comfortable with that. So, yeah.
Amen. Amen. So thank you for sharing. And everything you said is so fitting, as this is our MLK episode. And while many romanticize the relationships people had with King and that everyone was boots on the ground marching for civil rights, I've talked to people who were close with King, people like Wyatt T. Walker, who will tell you flat out, a lot of, just like you were not invited to certain places, certain friendships lost. Same thing happened to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I just believe there's a consistent theme that the people that are really an advocate, those who are really in the fight for justice, what is godly right and equality, are often pushed out, cast out, or, you know, chastised. They criticize Jesus. How can we expect everybody to follow and love on somebody who's fighting for justice? Because to be an advocate is to be a disruptor. Mm-hmm. It is to shake up those who are too comfortable while you're trying to bring comfort to those who've been shaken up throughout their entire life. And so I appreciate you. I appreciate you willing to make the sacrifice of not getting the invites, of risking friendships for what's right. And so we need more of that. So let me ask you, what has been, you mentioned your family, and I met your father. Shout out to your parents, great people. What has been your biggest motivator or motivation for having that moral compass that you speak about, besides your parents? What drives you to be an advocate? And even maybe you could even articulate for the audience what being an advocate for justice and equality means. And I'm using terms, you may have other terms you prefer to use, but I'm saying justice and equality.
Sacrifice. I'll just hone it in on sacrifice, you know, and that sacrifice is, it's much like, you know, you say I can't use my pants, but I have to, because
that's, okay,
you know, so
no problem. Go ahead, go with it.
Seeing her, and you know, hearing about how she would, you know, she retired from the Department of Transportation after 35 years, and we've never went hungry. We've never, you know, went unclothed, or you know. Just we had it all, you know. And I remember hearing the stories, you know, with my mother. And we would talk, and she would talk about how she would make sure my sister and I had lunch with me, or that we were, you know, taken care of in terms of before and after school programs, and how she would, for lunch for years, even if, you know, if she was hungry. Of course, she would have breakfast at home, but then for lunch, how she would eat some barbecue corn chips and orange juice, you know, for lunch for years. And I was just like, you know, we're just talking about sacrifice. And that was for her kids. And so I didn't know that, but again, innately, I felt the love and I felt the things that she was doing, you know. And so when I was of age, in terms of able to make decisions, my motivating factor was my mother and grandmother, not to disappoint them. I was tempted to sell drugs, you know, my friends were around. And here's the other part, they never try to get me to sell drugs. Like, God is always, I've always been, like, God has always had, I can't speak for anybody else, I'm gonna speak for me. I firmly believe how we normally say, and I'm not this over religious guy and all that stuff either, but I believe, I know who I am and who's not. I hear people, and I used to say, you know, something told me not to do, or I just didn't feel like going to that party. Number one, I wasn't allowed to. I wasn't going to have a friend, but I wasn't allowed to. But the other side was, it was just, you know, I didn't have the desires to be a risk taker. Even to this day, it shocks people. Like when I would go to certain meetings or go to school board meetings and speak up for and out against the system or the powers that were, you know, the boogeymans in the back rooms and all that stuff, people would be like, well, wow, well, we wanted to say that. I'm like, well, why didn't you? Everybody had a chance to get to the mic. But they didn't, I guess, have that tenacity to do for the masses, even if it meant sacrificing yourself. And something that sticks out to me a lot was, I'll never forget the entire, and this is how God works, the entire fourth grade at Marshall Elementary failed reading, right? And we were at class every day, and you know, so forth and so on, but the entire fourth grade, myself included, failed reading. And the reason why we failed reading is because we didn't complete the fourth grade curriculum for reading. Well, why didn't we complete the fourth grade curriculum for reading? Because we got our books late. So it wasn't our fault that we didn't complete the entire fourth grade. But I learned something that always stuck with me. I remember hearing my mother and Kareem Pitt's mother on the phone together and talking about how they were going to call. Back then it was Channel 8, Channel 15, and Channel 21. That's all, those only news stations we had here. and how they were going to go, and that just the two of them was going to protest because it wasn't right. Now they try to rally everybody, but just those two women, you know, and a significant others went to advocate for an entire school of fourth grade, or a section at least, but yeah, a school of fourth graders basically, you know, on that wing of Marshall Elementary School, because we didn't pass, you know, and it wasn't right. It wasn't our fault. And then I can remember my mother taking us going to school board meetings. I can remember her calling the news stations. I remember sitting in the superintendent's office and he wouldn't come out. I remember all of this. And what it showed me was absolute power corrupts absolutely, and power can seize nothing without demand. And what I mean by that is my mother and Kareem Pitts' mother, Mrs. Pitts, they continued that fight. They did call the news. They showed up at the meeting to the point where they only put, they meaning the powers that be, put two of us, myself and Kareem Pitts, in a reading recovery program, just to hush our moms up, basically. Well, that was a reading recovery program, but we didn't have anything to recover from. We never got the information. So it's as if we failed it. And so they went back again. It was like, well, that's not good enough, because they're just going to be, you know, as if they're going to be in fourth grade again. And that wasn't the point. So they advocated to the point where we got into a reading, whatever it was called, that summer. And then we ended up taking two readings for the first half. I'm sorry, we ended up taking fifth grade as well as the fourth grade reading that next year, that next school year, for a half a year until we really got. So there's like, we don't want them to not have what it is they need, but we want them to, you know, get what was theirs. And what it taught me was advocacy and continue to push what was right and that was convenient. Other parents, I'm not knocking them. I'm not naming other people I was in fourth grade with, but they didn't go on to fifth grade reading, you know? And that, as a man now, and this I say how God works, I have a master's now as a reading specialist. And who else, and I wasn't the smartest one in the classroom, who else fell victim to that fourth grade slump, you know, the traditional fourth grade slump that we all talk about, not even talking about the fact that we didn't have books, but the traditional fourth grade slump. And I don't, that's not lost on me in terms of how my mother and Mrs. Pitts advocated for us and we got what we needed and deserved, and how those who weren't advocated for did not get. Now, they were advocating for us first, but not only. But of course, the powers that be was like, okay, we're just doing it for them. And that's what happened, you know? So that's, you know, I guess with one of the things that, you know, was really, you know, instrumental in terms of the political things, in terms of what I learned, in terms of advocacy and going after things that are necessary. And no matter how big the Goliath is, you know, David, with faith and courage, can still come through on the other side. And, you know, politically, second lessons aside from that, that I learned politically was, and I won't mention his name, but there was a coach and his wife, and I ended up making the All-Star team. And I got along with the wife, but I didn't get along. They ended up coaching the All-Star team at Southeast Baseball. Not that I was good. My mom was at all the games, so they felt obligated, I guess. She was advocating. So I ended up on the team, and we had practice one day, and I felt comfortable talking to, you know, Mrs. Such and Such about Mr. Such and Such. And I didn't know the real strength of a relationship and a marriage as a kid. I just think, grown up, next thing I know, I was off the team, you know? And that taught me something too, in terms of when to bridle your tongue and
yeah, and knowing the room. Yeah.
And the irony is that I just saw this gentleman, you know, on the corner, fell on some hard times. And he saw me, I saw him, and I passed through because I was in traffic. I felt compelled. This is honest to God, not even 3 days ago. I circled back around the block, and he's like, "Hey, Mr. Singleton." I was like, "Nah." Well, I ain't gonna say his name. I was like, "Nah, Coach Such and Such." I was like, "This is Carl, this is Pie from Hall Manor." And I was like, "He's like, just came back in town, fell on some hard times." I was like, "You ain't gotta explain nothing to me." But that's how God works.
Yeah.
I'm picturing now, and it's just like one of those things. And but that's the same thing that gives me fuel, because there's people in this community who are great at what they do, great at what they did. They have so much to offer, but they don't have access to that opportunity. Like I say to people, if I'm there, we're there. So if I got access to it, I'm giving it. I'm not holding the information. And that's one of the things I think that being in these blessed positions, whether it's in administration or as an educator, in the schools around here, just being able to have, be able to at least point to where the resources are, if not taking individuals in need of resources directly to them. I don't take that lightly.
Awesome. So you mentioned about systems, and I know of all that you said a lot just now, but I want to talk about that. We're in an age where the fact of me even bringing this up, people, some would accuse me of race baiting, whatever that means. But we're in an age where some people have gotten so comfortable that they feel like there is no such thing as systemic oppression or injustice. I believe it's alive and well, and I believe you believe that as well. What are some of the systemic injustices that people may be victim of that they don't even know they're a victim of, or some things that we see? And I believe this is not just limited to Harrisburg, because Harrisburg is just a reflection of all cities across the United States of America and even other parts of the world. What are some systemic injustices that we see every day that we all can be an advocate against or fight against?
I just think that the education system, period, no matter where you are, the education system. And I don't need you're being much more kind than me. And you say systemic injustice, it's systemic racism. Because the injustice is predicated upon race and or classism. And so see when Cass, I got this book Cass back here. Great book. I'm not pub, but it's a great book. You gotta read. I haven't read it in entirety, but I've seen enough. But let's go back to when you're talking about injustices, the system is working exactly the way the system is intended to work. There is a need to maintain a permanent working class. And I firmly believe, and I've said this for years, here in Harrisburg in particular, look around at any city, especially an urban city that's been intentionally disinvested in. And I guarantee you'll see two things that go on. You'll see in terms of high schools in particular, education, that's why I went back to education. You'll see an attack and a removal of the trades and the arts, and you'll see it pacified with sports, and particularly basketball and football. Because the arts, you can be self-sufficient. I'm not telling anybody to drop out or anything like that. But the arts and the trades, you are self-sufficient once you learn that skill. There's no, now, we've created systemically the need for this certification and that certification and all of that. But that's a moneymaker, much like the state teachers' exams and the SATs are moneymakers, which we know. We have created the inability for people to be self-sufficient to the degree where we have control. We meaning the overall system. And so examples of injustices that we see every day, just merely let's talk about I'm into as a chief equity and compliance officer, making sure that however the city spends their money is equitable with regards to minority women-owned and controlled businesses. So if you and I show up looking the way that we do, why do we need a certification to say that we're a minority business? Right? Everybody is stigmatized, males in particular, black women in particular, as minorities. Why do we need a certification in order to have access? You ever think of that? That burns me out. Well,
Yeah, I've
now.
thought about it, and if Dr. Umar Johnson was here, he would talk about how after the riots of 68, all of this changed.
So I know him well, as a matter of fact. I had him here as the first principal at Premier Arts and Science Charter School where I'm a founder member. So he was
awesome.
But that in itself has been normalized to the point where we just accepted the system, right? And we don't even challenge the system. We just accept that that's what it is.
Yeah.
Now, I think that's some inequity right there.
Yeah.
A white male doesn't have to come in and prove that he's a white male, nor does he need a certification. Right?
Right.
In terms of as a minority business or something like that. In the meantime, mm-hmm. that you need to have MBE set up, MBE certification set up to ensure that you put into the RFP or a contract or something that we want to create access or the, I'll say, modern day level of playing field, old time affirmative action types of measures. That says on his face that you acknowledge the fact that there's been historical practices of discrimination and intentional omission.
Right.
You want to, you know, come to the table and really fight and talk, you know, speak to that point. A lot of individuals campaign on that type of stuff. A lot of individuals, you know, when they're in their quiet silos of friendship and safety, they talk about that type of stuff. But when it's time to be a decision maker and put pen to paper and or to create policy and legislation that really atones for, at least attempts to atone for, that which was done, you know, in an unjust way historically, they get cold feet, you know. And, you know, we see it every day, you know, on a local, state, and federal level. And one of the things I will say is the onus on us in our communities is to understand, I've said this in the church when we were having a community forum, getting out and going to meetings and voting, that's only the first step, series of steps. Well, now yeah. make sure that the agenda that you was pushing at this individual or individuals decided that that was good campaign material that they actually follow up on. Like, we have new members on city council now. Welcome. You know, we have now a full, you know, city council that's very diverse in terms of mindset, thinking, backgrounds, etc. And everybody campaigned on, you know, doing what's right, not for one section or this, that, and the other, but for everybody. But the way that they get there is based on their experiences. The way that we can advocate is based on an agenda that we put together that should be doing what? Addressing and lifting up the least of us to make sure that whole thing about rising tides, lift all boats. Well, all right, let them rise. Let's make sure some people aren't having their yachts lifted, some people their canoes, and some people, you know, paddle boats. You know, so, you know, we don't have enough political will and courage at a local, state, and or federal and or county level, you know, that's going to really, in my opinion, that has really stood the course of time and has really advocated for the masses as opposed to just for the chosen few.
Yeah, well said. Thank you for sharing that. And one of the things I'm hearing is it's not that the opportunities are not there for us to advocate for ourselves. Is that sometimes we're in the position and people lack the courage to say what needs to be said. Right. So I thank God for people who have the courage, who are not so focused on personal gain that they forget about the community. To me, the reality is...
No, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I'm saying there's another part to it as well. There's people in the community that have historically had the community's trust, and they have name recognition, right? And then they're here and they speak on behalf of the community when the community is watching. But when the community is no longer there, that agenda changes.
Yeah.
And so, again, it goes back to people are more inclined to do what you inspect as opposed to what you expect. So I can't let the community off the hook in terms of me included. Because if there's something that we've advocated for, something that we said we wanted, we need to follow through with it, see it through the whole process, you know? And if not, just because you look like me, just because, you know, we grew up together, that doesn't mean I think you're a leader. It doesn't mean I can't be your friend either. But there's a
right.
business. You know, this right here, we are talking about future generations, plural, that are going to be directly impacted by decisions that are made. We are feeling, long before you got here, the effects, the ill effects of a broken school district in a city on that was facing bankruptcy is our fault. Those of us that were here that weren't unified enough to see an agenda through to make sure those that we elected were really doing the will of the people as opposed to taking for self. And then what you have is you have a couple of people that will show up looking like us and they'll say, no, we are helping the community. And they'll point to the same five people historically, you know, and those same five people are the only ones getting invited to the table. And they're the ones that basically helping tank the community. You know?
Yeah.
I have a list. I don't know if you want to. I have a list.
No, we're not going to name names on this episode.
I'm serious. I have a list, and I would, without fear of any retribution, and I've said it for years, I would challenge anyone, especially those that I would have on the that I have on the list, to say how they did not help tank the school district, and or the city, and or the Harrisburg Authority. So I mean, the incinerator deals. I mean, there's things we are now feeling the effects of decisions that were made in 96, from 96 specifically, from 96 to 2006, that we still probably won't be out from under and fully recovered from in our generation.
Wow.
That help are still around.
Oh yeah, that's usually the case. And some people, I'm going to use this word again, romanticize them and the impact that they had, knowing that they did more damage or harm than good. And so we have to be careful about elevating people or creating this false narrative. But I want to come back on something you mentioned about sometimes we hurt ourselves, or we have been guilty, or we have some of the blame ourselves. I recently asked a group of preachers, if Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, would he be spending more time addressing internal issues within the Black community or external issues from oppressors? What do you believe?
Did you have this amongst pastors?
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a forum. I just was asking a question.
You asked a question, but I have a third edition.
Okay.
I think he would be addressing the internal issues of the church and those very pastors. That's what I think. Because some of the people I'm speaking of were in those roles of pastors, reverends that helped some of the previous elected officials, you know, kind of turn out the cheek, so to speak.
You know? Wow, that's good.
Yeah,
I did not see that response coming, but I can definitely believe it. Yeah,
forward look. That's and women as well, so they're human. But then again, it comes back on the people and the masses in terms of, because it doesn't. Again, they're human. They're flesh, right?
Right.
Me as well. That doesn't mean I don't have family and people don't love me and I think I'm doing right and I just so happen to be making the wrong decision. It just means you shouldn't be in a leadership position.
Right.
You know, because your leadership position is not about you. Again, going back to my mother, you're in a position to empower the position and not be empowered by the position. So they just needed, I guess the church saying is they just need to be sat down and not be sent. Some people, they say, you know, were sent, other people just went. They should go in that direction, you know, and not only the church, I'm talking about anybody that, to those tables and, you know, and forget why they're there or intentionally misuse the reasons why they're there. And again, as a man of faith, we do hold you all in different positions, more high esteem. So the accountability is greater as well. You know, I'm a firm believer.
Yeah.
You don't play with God, especially with his flock and in the house. You don't do that. You know,
amen.
I'm not a pastor.
Amen. No, I agree wholeheartedly.
It would be that good look, I think.
Yeah. So this speaks to something else. I'll never forget, I was in seminary at Princeton, and I met a young lady who really, it was just starting an organization we now know as Black Lives Matter. And I remember Cornel West and a few others having a conversation about this being the first movement that does not include the church, and the danger that exists if God is not the centerpiece of a justice movement. This next part of this conversation for me is not advocating for BLM, because so many people have different opinions about Black Lives Matter, but more so addressing the church and the lack of relevance in these issues of advocating for our community, being present in the conversations about what needs to happen. And then sometimes when a representative is picked, and I will say hand-picked, they are somebody that the puppet master knows they're going to go alongside their agenda. How do we as a people, and I'll even say as a church, and I'm saying this as a pastor, how do we get back to where we used to be, where we are the light in darkness, where we are the ones speaking truth to power, where we are the ones who are bold enough to say what needs to be said, rather than being so concerned about our grant money or being so concerned about our relationships. We want to take all these pictures with all these other people who care nothing about you. How do we get away from where we are now and get to where we used to be? And again, I don't want to fully romanticize eras like the 60s, because I know, and I've read some old sermons from national conventions where they were talking about banning Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. because he wasn't preaching salvation. He was preaching justice, which I don't know how you separate the two.
Justice.
That's right. It's the same. I don't know how you disassociate the two, but how do we get back to a place of consciousness and intentionality?
You nailed it. Consciousness and intentionality and courage. I mean, it goes back to courage, and it goes back to, you know, I think it goes back to clearly understanding that these positions that we are in are but temporary. You know, they're not ours. You know, if you didn't come from a good family, free good family that you hope that you would have had, you know, if you didn't come from, you know, a solid, you know, upbringing, create things and place, create spaces where others can have that solid upbringing. Just because you didn't have it doesn't mean others shouldn't, especially if you know that's something that you were yearning for. But let me go back. When you started talking about, you know, again, the, I think the misuse of our church, our churches, you know, in particular, places of faith and worship overall, everybody as leaders don't go to churches, and or, you know, I would say places of worship. I go to a church, but you know what we're saying is, I think it's important for several reasons not to send an individual or two individuals into a meeting. I just firmly believe that. Number one, we can hear the same thing, but we have different perspectives.
Yep.
I think hands down. I believe that. I think there's strength in numbers, and all of those meetings after the meetings and meetings before the meetings and all that stuff to set the agenda, but then there's the real agenda. You know, I think the leadership, which we look to, you know, since I can remember, in terms of the churches, were compromised, and you went back to the grant money, you went back to the 501c3 status. Well, no one threatens the church's, especially Black churches. No one threatens Black churches' 501c3 status when white, Black, Latino, LGBTQ, or whoever else wants to come into the churches on Sunday and campaign. So have that same energy when we're talking about advocacy. on behalf of those blocks that are condemned around our church. You know, when a church decides to really take care of its people, I mean, you know, you can't really, I mean, when you look at churches in particular, I mean, we got more state buildings and churches in Harrisburg, 51% is tax exempt. You know, of that 51, of that 49% left, how many of that population is gainfully employed, meaning livable wages, you know, not minimum wage, but livable wages.
Mm-hmm.
And then of that number, what percentage of that number is making between 50 and 60,000 a year? What number? So if the church, in terms of which is, no pun intended, the cornerstone of those blocks, isn't addressing the intentional disinvestment and addressing the students, the church, here's how we can come back. Here's one, this is what I've always said. What if five churches from uptown, five from the south side, well, we'll split the hill and Berry Hills, so we'll split that a little bit so we make sure we got five. Five from the hill. What if they decided to go to M&T Bank, this five, Members First, that five, and MidPen, the other five. And those 15 pastors, right, said, we're going to put our money that we collect with these five, we're going to put their money over here in these three banks, this bank, that bank, and that bank. And then at the end, every quarter, we're going to see who gave us the biggest return on our investment, meaning who was really mutually beneficial to our investment. And those were the people that gave lines of credit. Those are the individuals that had low to moderate interest rate loans. And those are the individuals that were basically receptive of, not, I shouldn't say loans, there's grants, there's lines of credit, et cetera, and low interest rate loans. Imagine if we start leveraging power in a way that said, we're gonna move our money to those that are most responsive to helping us reestablish our communities around our church. The Community Reinvestment Act of 1968 intentionally addressed redlining. We just have redlining by another name going on now.
Right.
You know, but imagine if the churches who put money into a bank every Monday or Tuesday, I don't know when the churches take it, but at least once a week, imagine if five of you walked in with those checks and that cash. Imagine the amount of leverage you can have. And then every quarter, 15 of you got together. And this can be done in Lower Paxton, Stilton, this can be done in Middletown, this can be Central Pennsylvania overall. You know, imagine the amount of power that you would have. And if they don't, listen, you can't force them to do it. But they can't force you to keep your money there. So we'll go to another
bank. Right.
Or you were getting it done here over bank, you know, PYE. Okay, well, we're gonna go to bank PYE instead of having three banks that we deal with, the south side of town and hill. We're only going to deal with two. And then guess what? That one bank that y'all left is going to get the word out, and either PYE Bank is going to get on board, or y'all going to go back over to the other bank. Ain't no bank going to say they don't want your money. And then imagine what you can do, community development, corporations, et cetera, that you can do legitimately. You know, and it doesn't affect the 501c3 status, doesn't affect anything. And you're really giving service to the community beyond the church walls, beyond Sunday. It's really Sunday to Sunday. And that is political will and power and capital all together at once. And that will allow an agenda to be set for the masses as opposed to just the chosen few. Not just church masses, but the masses in terms of the people.
Yeah. So one of the challenges I see in urban churches is people are extremely focused on those who are quote unquote members, which you should be. People come to the church to grow, to serve. We want to be intentional about them. But there's a huge disconnect within the community. Most of the membership at many churches drive in from a county or at least 20 to 30 minutes away. And so they're not invested in the community. I personally believe we have to be more intentional, even if you are in a gentrified community, to be connected to the community. That's just my belief. You need to know who your neighbors are and how you can grow and sustain that community, whether it's five different nations surrounding you on one block. You need to be intentional about knowing that community. And like you said, doing the work of developing, and economic empowerment is so important. Most churches, I'll share this, most churches feel like a victim to the banking industry. Banks often refuse to lend to churches because they feel like it's risky. Banks feel like churches aren't safe, especially with the major decline in many churches and in many denominations of membership. But what I say is, you don't have to be a victim. You can control your own narrative. Go ahead. I feel like you want to say something.
No, I mean, I always got something to say. I think you mentioned Cornel West earlier, and sometimes I'm hot and cold with him. Depends on if you're talking that.
Yeah.
You know, every day. I think he's a brilliant brother, you know, but I think he can be almost to the agenda's detriment, too inclusive. If we get self.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
So I'll just say one thing that I do stick by with him is, you can't serve the people if you don't love the people. And you can't love them if you're scared of them. So you can't be scared of your very community. You know, and you can't forget where you came from, because you're still there, and you're subject to return. You know, God has put you in certain positions. He's put you there. You didn't earn it. He's put you there in certain positions. And so you got to be careful how you treat people on your way up. Those are the same behind you got to see on your way down. You know, and, you know, the fall is greater, the higher you rise if you misuse, you know, God's people, you know, human capital in general for selfish gains. I firmly believe that. So I think, you know, when we're speaking specifically, I guess now about the church, you know, I was fortunate. I was blessed. I've had, you know, churches that I've attended where, again, and I've been blessed, where people, pastors in particular, saw more in me than what I saw in myself. And the mere fact that, you know, you feel the love, you know, as a 16, 18 year old or 25 year old, whatever, you know, and they're saying, you know, like, you can do this. And the expectation is for you. And it wasn't pressure. It was encouraging, you know, and I never felt like they were in competition, you know. And when I started doing what it is that they said they would, you know, that they believed I could do, they invited others around me too, not just to pour into me, but for me to say, hey, this is what such and such said to me, and I believe that here's the track that I'm taking, and not flawed at all, huh? Trust me, a lot of flaws, you know, but it at least was an opportunity, because all peer pressure is not bad. Some peer pressure
right.
Can be in the right direction.
And inspiration.
So I think, you know, again, when we're talking about, you know, church and the community, that economic empowerment, you know, I remember, you know, a pastor one day saying, why do I as a Baptist pastor only get credibility if I don't look like I have anything? What is that saying about God? So why should I drive around in a broken down car? Why can't I have a nice car? Why can't I have a nice house? Why can't I dress nice? It's not to the detriment or taken from anyone else, but your reflection of servant leadership and you don't have to, you know, look a certain way that is not becoming, if you will, you know, or you don't prove by trying to do something and living outside your means either. If, you know, the church, or if you're not working, you know, if all you have the church income and people were struggling to pay their bills, and you're still saying, you know, tithes and offerings, there's a place for that as well, I believe. Because I'm a believer as well that tithing is not only money, you know.
Yes, time.
Yeah, so.
And I'm a talent.
You know, so that, again, those trades, something goes wrong in the church, you want somebody to tithe you, you know, $200, or come and take care of that $15,000 plumbing job.
Yeah. Good stuff. Man, you've blessed me today. I appreciate you. I want to ask one final question for someone who is looking for an opportunity to be an advocate, if somebody feels that something just isn't right in their community, where would you say is a great place for them to start?
Internally, with themselves. What is it that you're advocating for? And is it just for self, or is it for more than just you and your family?
Right.
I'll just say, as an advocate, and you know, over the years, I've lost a lot of relationships, family units, friendships. You know, I've been on opposite sides politically, advocating with childhood friends that, I mean, we still were cordial, but you know, it's not what it was, you know, and I'm not saying it'll ever go back to where it was. Now, I wouldn't, you know, say I don't wish ill on anyone, but one thing about me, people will say, I can't control what they say, but they're flat out non-truth tellers. I'm not allowed, my grandma's picture's up over my shoulder, so I can't say the hell word.
You say naysayer now, that's the term.
If they say that I've did anything to women, adversely impact anything in regards to women, children, or the elderly, not true. Now, if they said I had some run-in with some men, especially peers, pray for me, you know? But yeah. I'll just simply say an advocate, I believe, should be in a position where he or she should be willing to say what's right and not what's merely convenient. That's going to benefit the masses and not just the chosen few. I think that's where advocacy starts. Seeing something that's wrong and addressing it and then rallying others around it, because no one's an island to themselves. And it takes, you know, many hands make work light. And we need to make sure those hands that are helping are clean, not perfect, but clean hands, not necessarily perfect hands. And I'll stop.
Yeah.
Thank you for the opportunity.
No, man.
The Mac attack.
Yeah, man. Appreciate you, man. And the only other thing I'll add to that is when you start addressing money, a lot of people talk about, again, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And he was doing all the marching for voters' rights and against segregation. He was just fine. But once he started addressing wage, income, and economic inequality, that's when he got murdered or assassinated. And so there are fights that will be more costly. But he had a dream and a vision that was bigger than himself. And like Brother Pius also said, you have to recognize it's bigger than you. But no going in, everybody's not going to be a fan. Everybody's not going to be a friend. I often say everything is, what'd you say?
So I was saying, don't forget about that. We can talk about Malcolm X as well as Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
When they had the realization that there's strength in numbers and unifying, setting an agenda, that's when the assassinations took place. Economics and unification. America runs, capitalism runs off of division. You know, so I'll tell you, on my side, I'm involved with Penn State Dickinson Law's Anti-Racist Leadership Development Institute. And, you know, Dr. Dean Conway is a looker, let your base know. We're talking about equity, inclusivity, advocacy, addressing systems, through this process called system designs, design thinking. Look up the Anti-Racist Leadership Development Institute, and it's managed by Ms. Tawanda Starworth, two sisters doing a phenomenal job, you know, around equity, inclusivity, very diverse collection of talent, educators throughout the nation. And they're starting where? At Penn State Dickinson Law in Carlisle. So if there's any—
all places.
Yeah, if there's any type of legal rebuttal, I would pick no one better than Dean Conway to be at the table with. So, yeah.
Amen. Amen.
That's one.
For those who listen and are unfamiliar with Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that was one of the KKK capitals of the country. Like that was a place known for its racism or racist attacks. And so Dickinson being in Carlisle and being a place of the School of Law, being a place where they're fighting for justice, they're literally in the lion's mouth and they are doing great work. And so shout out to them, Dean Conway and others. Thank God for them and all that they do. One last thing I want to say when we talk about unity and coming and the power of coming together. There's a book that came out in the early 2000s called Disintegration. And it talked about how we as a people used to pretty much have one class. And now because we have our own caste system and so many other separate entities within African-American culture, we have become so divided. It's not impossible, but it is such a struggle to get us unified. I hope and pray that I live to see the day where our people can come together under one thought, one sound, one voice for hope, for peace, for justice, for equality. Until then, keep praying, keep believing. Brother Singleton, thank you so much for being on here. Keep doing the work. Sometimes it may feel exhausting. Sometimes you may feel like you're sacrificing, but I just believe God will give you more and restore you, and God will upgrade. God doesn't replace, God upgrades. So any friends you lost, God will send better. Anything you lost, God will send better. So keep doing what you're doing, man. Proud of you as a father. Your children are doing amazing, and I'm just proud of you, man. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. And again, thank you for the opportunity. Just keep me lifted in prayer, as I will do for you.
Yes,
well.
Sir.
I appreciate you.
Yes, sir.
All right.
All right, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.